I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. The Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra's new season begins next month, and at the same time, the Philharmonic is searching for a new music director. I'll talk with Philharmonic Executive Director David Schilhammer about what's next for Orlando's resident professional orchestra. And while it might be hot outside, there's still a little time left this summer for outdoor activity. New Chairman Kenneth Wright will discuss the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's oversight of hunting, fishing, and boating in the state. That's ahead on Intersection. That is the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra performing Beethoven's Symphony No. 6 last year. The Philharmonic is getting ready to celebrate its 20th anniversary and searching for a new music director. Maestro Christopher Wilkins will conclude an 8-year tenure in 2014. So this creates another transition for Orlando's arts community. Construction underway on a new downtown performing arts center. United Arts of Central Florida is tasked with promoting region's arts, and they have a new president for the first time in a decade. So a lot of movement in the Central Florida arts community. Philharmonic Executive Director David Schilhammer is with me now to discuss what's next for Orlando's resident professional orchestra. David, it's great to have you with us.
Well, it's great to have you, and it's wonderful to listen to a snippet of Beethoven 6. It brings me back to February 4, Saturday night, when we did perform that in tandem with Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. And, of course, the spring connection of the Pastorale Symphony was made for a real memorable occasion. And although the audience loved the performance of Beethoven 6, it brought down the house with the Rite of Spring and was really gratifying for the orchestra to have the audience respond so enthusiastically.
And those are not easy pieces. Rite of Spring created riots in Paris.
It did. And, we were concerned that Orlando audiences, which were somewhat a little bit more traditional and conservative in their programming, might not respond well to it, but they did. It was an occasion to remember, and it was an event, and it's a piece of work that you don't hear every day or every decade or even every generation, and certainly it was the first time in Orlando Philharmonic history that we had performed it, and I was really, really proud of the orchestra. Just gave a stellar professional performance.
Well, for those of us who are maybe not as connected with classical music in Central Florida, give us a sense. What's the audience like for classical music here in the Orlando area?
Well, the audience for classical music is growing enthusiastically over the years. We were just looking at some statistics today. In 2006, 2007, we had 1,400 subscribers. And for next year, our 20th anniversary season, we'll have 4,000 subscribers. It's, a couple hundred percent increase during what has been called the worst economic recession since the Great Depression. And we have found that our audiences continue to respond enthusiastically. We call it exciting programming marketed well is our mantra and the words that we live by. And every concert has to have a sense of occasion, and we have to market it intelligently in order to communicate what that occasion is to our audiences. And when we do those things well, people come out in record numbers. And every year for the last 5 years, we've had record-breaking attendance. So I'm happy to say that there's a healthy, burgeoning, and growing audience for the Orlando Philharmonic in Central Florida.
How has the orchestra changed over the past 20 years?
Well, it was a fledgling organization when it started. It happened, unfortunately, in the wake of the closure of the 43-year-old Florida Symphony. And there was a lot of community concern about whether or not Central Florida could support an orchestra. And as we embark on our 20th anniversary season, we're really hearkening back to the founders and what kind of perseverance they had to have to overcome the obstacles, because there were most people, community leaders, just simply didn't believe that an orchestra could exist, much less thrive in Central Florida. So there were a lot of naysayers.
Why do you think that was?
Well, the closer of the Florida Symphony was a prime example. Our predecessor organization had proved the case for them. There were unique problems at that time that hopefully we have corrected. And the founders came up with some guiding principles that became the core values of the Orlando Philharmonic. And I'll just briefly outline them: respect for musicians, involvement of musicians in all aspects of programming, governance, and administration, an absolute unwavering commitment to maintaining financial equilibrium to ensure the organization in perpetuity. We have balanced our budget for 19 consecutive years for every year of our existence. Passionate commitment to community. We want to be Central Florida's resident professional orchestra, and we demonstrate that through our incredible community collaborations. And the last is artistic excellence and innovation. So those four guiding principles, which are now our core values, have led the board and the management and the volunteers to make prudent decisions about how we proceed. And we're committed to financial stability and artistic excellence, and they're not mutually exclusive.
Now, you're also looking for a new music director. What does the music director do?
The music director of an orchestra is obviously the artistic chief of the institution, overseeing all aspects of artistic development, including orchestra personnel, programming, commissioning, guest artists, rehearsing the orchestra, being the artistic leader. And we have certainly enjoyed the tremendous work of our music director, Christopher Wilkins. He's our second music director in our history. We started with Hal France, who had a wonderful six-year term. And Chris really took what Hal had done and then propelled it further. Chris has been a great community collaborator over the years, whether it be the Orlando Museum of Art or the Negro Spiritual Scholarship Foundation, the Zora Neale Hurston Festival, or in the case of our 20th anniversary season, a collaboration with Orlando Shakespeare Theater in a really unusual performance of A Midsummer Night's Dream, where we'll be performing the orchestra on stage with all the incidental music but written by Mendelssohn, with the great talented actors and director Jim Helsinger from Orlando Shakespeare providing the action. And it's very rarely performed that way, but it's those types of community involvement and community collaborations that I think have been a hallmark of our success.
Well, let's turn back to some of those staples, I guess, of orchestral performance. You've got the Beethoven 6th Symphony, the Pastorale. Let's listen just to a little bit more of it under the baton of Christopher Wilkins, who joined the Philharmonic in 2006. What do you think Christopher Wilkins is able to achieve and bring out in the players?
Well, he's a very sensitive musician. He is a great leader. He I think has worked well with each of the sections in the orchestra to bring out the best. He's developed new players. We've been able to bring in a whole new crop of players. If you look at the front desk of the orchestra, the concertmaster, principal second, principal viola, principal cello are all new and have this youthful enthusiasm. And so he's brought a great energy to the performances and a new fresh look at some traditional works. But again, he's also has had a lifelong commitment to American music and specifically the commissioning of American composers. And our body of work with our composer in residence, Stella Song, is really something to be proud of as an institution, and really give kudos to Chris for those kinds of things.
So in searching for a new music director, does that mean you're searching for a new direction?
No, I don't think so. I think, 8 years is about average, even above average for an American music director, and orchestras and conductors plan years and years in advance. And so I don't really see it as looking for a new direction, but an embracing of who we are first and foremost, and then seeing, you know, where we can go in the future in relation to the opening of the Dr. Phillips Center. But no, I don't want to get ahead of the board, because we even haven't even had our first meeting about exactly what we're looking for. But we're not looking for any kind of dramatic change, more of a smooth continuity of change and embracing of who we are and embracing of Central Florida and finding new ways to celebrate that.
You hit on that new Dr. Phillips Performing Arts Center, which is scheduled to be complete in 2014. How is that going to change things for the Philharmonic?
Well, initially, it's not going to change anything for the Orlando Philharmonic. What's opening in 2014 is the 2,800-seat non-acoustic Broadway hall, which is something that Central Florida desperately needs, and we completely support. But it is not a new home for the Orlando Philharmonic. As I say, it's a hall designed for amplified sound, not for the natural sound of a symphony orchestra. That's not to say that we might not do a special event a year or so there, but we will wait for the second theater to be built, the 1,700-seat multi-form hall that is being built specifically for symphony, opera, and ballet. So we'll be at Bob Carr for a few more years until the funding is assembled through a variety of mechanisms that are almost too complicated to go into, but the tourist development tax, philanthropy, and government politics all hopefully colliding in a positive way.
Where has the Philharmonic been as those discussions are going on? Because you're going to be the beneficiary of this going on. And, I mean, you do have an interest in making sure it comes together.
We've been at the table, and then we've not been at the table. I think we were at the table for the many years of design of the theater to ensure that the space works well for an orchestra, for opera. And also we're an organization that is very theatrical in our presentations. We do our concert musicals, our operas are theatrical. And so we want to make sure that it is a space that can accommodate a variety of different types of productions. And we were wonderfully at the table for that. I think mercifully we're not at the table for the politics and some of the machinations that are going on that are absolutely necessary and people are really working hard for at all levels of our civic community, government, and private are working hard for that. We're not really at the table for that. We remain an interested spectator and activist in supporting the process. We supported from the beginning all three venues. We supported that we needed all three for Orlando to be great. We're thrilled there's a new event center for the Orlando Magic. We're even happy that the Citrus Bowl is going to be renovated in advance of when we thought it would be, because I've been to the Citrus Bowl. I know it needs renovation. So the extent to which that those things can happen without negatively impacting the multi-form hall, we're supportive of. So, you know, we're here for the community, and we want the whole entire community to succeed.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with Orlando Philharmonic Executive Director David Schillhammer. I'm Mark Simpson. Are you a music lover? Do you love the Philharmonic? Tell us what you like about it. What is it about that experience of hearing the orchestra play? Tell us on Facebook or Twitter. Send an email over to intersection@WMFE.org. Talk to me about fundraising and finances, David, because, you know, United Arts of Central Florida, one of the major arts organizations in this area, missed its fundraising goal this spring for the first time in a decade. They've got a new director themselves, Flora Maria Garcia, who we had on just a few weeks ago on this program. So how are things going for the Philharmonic? Is it equally challenging?
Well, as I mentioned, we have wonderfully been able to balance our annual operating budget for 19 consecutive years. We have a little over a $3 million operating budget. We have about a $700,000 opera budget that is separate and distinct from the Philharmonic, and we've managed to balance that for each of the first 3 years that since we assumed the production of opera after the demise of Orlando Opera. We've had record-breaking ticket sales, as I've mentioned, and we have had record-breaking philanthropy. I have to give credit to our individual donor base has been very passionate and enthusiastic about making good contributions. We've had steady support from the corporate base. I confess it's very difficult as corporations are looking at every penny. The local foundation community has continued to be generous to the extent that they can. And government has maintained rather well. Orange County, the city of Orlando, even the state of Florida. We got an increase from the state of Florida this year. So overall, it's been okay. I think the main concern that I have as a 13-year veteran of this community, and I know Flora Maria shares this and so do other community leaders, is the fact that the cultural community is undercapitalized. And it extends to all nonprofits, but in the arts in particular. When Orlando Opera went under, it had almost no endowment. And the Orlando Philharmonic, at $3.8 million in endowment, has the largest endowment of any cultural institution. But that's really not saying much. It's really not sufficient. The League of American Orchestras, the National Arts Stabilization Board recommend for a nonprofit arts organization to have an endowment 5 times the size of its operating budget. So we've got a lot of room to grow as a cultural community. So my main concern is that as these annual dollars are very, very difficult, we need to get off the treadmill, stay on the treadmill, but also get off the treadmill and think more long term. So the Philharmonic is going to be very aggressive over the next 5 years in trying to raise about $12 million in endowment for the Philharmonic, and we'd like to have a $2 million endowment for opera as well.
Well, let's talk about your upcoming 2012-2013 season. It opens in September. You're going to be performing Mahler's Symphony No. 3, which is a piece that starts out very dark in the beginning, but it does start to soar, and we've got a bit of that right here. That should wake you up.
Can't wait. Chris really wanted to do a major work on the opening of the anniversary season that demonstrated and showed off the virtuosity of the individual musicians, sort of like Rite of Spring did. And we've had good success with people. Again, every concert has to be an event, and you don't hear Mahler 3 very often, especially in Orlando. So we're very, very excited, and we get to work with the University of Central Florida Choir and the Florida Opera Theater Choir as well. It's going to be a tour de force.
How do you think that's setting the tone for the season?
Well, we had a lot of debate about that, but it's going to be very exciting, and it's going to have people on the edge of their seats in anticipation of all the concerts to come. And I think we've assembled the most exciting season in our history, and rightly so for our 20th anniversary. We have on the classical side, we're bringing in 3 real giants. Soloists, Yefim Bronfman on piano, Deborah Voigt, soprano, and Sarah Chang on violin. Really 3 artists unparalleled at the top of their game, performing some great works. And so the classical series is just a home run, and we've seen just a huge explosion in the number of classical subscribers. And I already mentioned the Midsummer Night's Dream. And so there, you know, we start with Mahler and end with Midsummer Night's Dream, and then we have our bread and butter in the middle, and people are really excited and again, are subscribing in record numbers.
Well, I can tell that if you're scaling Mahler, you've set the bar high. So, David Schillhammer, thanks so much for stopping by. He's the executive director of the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it very much.
Up next, Kenneth Wright, the new chair of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, talks about his direction for the agency. Kenneth Wright is the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's new chairman. Wright is an Orlando area attorney. He was appointed to the commission in 2007 by then-Governor Charlie Crist. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission oversees hunting, fishing, boating, also engages in scientific research on behalf of the state's fish and wildlife species. Ken, it's great to have you in.
Mark, it's nice to be with you as well.
Great. Well, talk to me a little bit about some of those iconic Florida species. Everyone thinks of alligators, of course, in Florida, manatees, panthers. Those flagship species, how are they doing?
They're doing well. They're doing very well, in fact. We just recently celebrated 2 successes. The American bald eagle has come off of the endangered list, and the Florida black bear as well. We have over the years seen these animals succeed. I'm recently reminded that we have more eagles in the state of Florida than back in the 60s were in the entire country. So the eagles are doing very well. We should celebrate that success. Same with our black bears. Panthers, of course. We're only limited by geography on panthers to their habitat down in South Florida, but there's a lot of attention to panthers, and they're doing very well.
And when you say that certain species have been taken off of the endangered list, do you mean that at a state level or nationally?
They've been taken off nationally as well. The Eagle is off the list in Florida.
Now, your agency also has to tackle the problem of invasive species, and those come in many different categories, both animals and plants. I know on the plant side, you're always fighting against hydrilla, which is a kind of invasive water plant, but also, python's been getting a lot of attention down in the Everglades as an invasive species that seems to be breeding quite a lot.
Pythons, unfortunately, came from a part of Asia that is very similar to South Florida. It's very temperate, and once they were released into the wild, they were at home. They took over. They have really, once they get beyond their very early stages in age, they essentially have no predators, and they just grow unchecked, and it is a problem.
Of course, we're in the middle of the summer season, and outdoor recreation gets a lot of Floridians active. And an economic analysis by the FWC recently found that outdoor recreation like hunting and fishing and wildlife viewing brings in about $15 billion of impact into the state of Florida. And, of course, your agency has to make decisions, among other things. For example, what type of fish Floridians can actually go fishing for. Walk us through how you make these decisions in terms of regulating what catch limits should be and those sorts of things.
We were discussing recently the challenge of a new commissioner, and I think it probably took me a year before I felt like I could speak out loud at a commission meeting because it's highly technical. But the way we deal with fish is to preserve a fish population sufficient to sustain a level at which we're now experiencing them. So you take trout, for example. We're all familiar with the speckled sea trout in Central Florida over at Mosquito Lagoon. We have a lot of Central Floridians that fish over there for trout. We manage those based on a spawning potential ratio. It's a very intense effort by our research biologists to calculate how many fish can be taken out of what we know to be an existing population of that fishery and yet sustain it at a level which we desire. So we know what percentage of fish can be caught to maintain that fishery. Then we manage above that to be safe. And then some fish we manage even above that to make sure that we have an abundance of, like, snook, for example, a very highly sought after recreational fish. But we have the a research institute in St. Petersburg, which is one of the top, if not the top, marine research institutes in the world that gives us the data to make those calculations.
A lot of popular fish around Florida, the mahi, the grouper, the snook, as you mentioned, and certainly you also have to work with National Marine Fisheries. What's that relationship like, and are there ever disagreements between the two agencies about where the limit should be?
Well, we work with the National Marine Fisheries, of course, where there's an interaction between federal waters and our state waters. And where this has been a particularly difficult issue is with our Gulf Red Snapper. Many of our Central Floridians go to the Panhandle or over to the West Coast to fish for Red Snapper. They have been overfished. Everyone agrees that back in the 80s, the population had diminished to a critical point. Unfortunately, Congress, not unfortunately, but what creates a difficulty, in order for the matter to be dealt with, Congress passed the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which requires the federal government to take certain drastic efforts to reduce overfishing and to prevent this fish from being overfished. And that has resulted, as a lot of your listeners know, in a compression of the fishing season, the number of bag limits. So we're trying to get that fishery rebuilt. It's going to take some time. But to answer your question, the relationship between the FWC and our federal partners is good. We all want more fish and want people to be able to enjoy a day on the water and catch fish.
How long do you think it might take to rebuild a fishery? Decades? Or?
Mark, you and I could burn up the rest of your day on this show, but I'll try to make it as quick as possible. A lot of your listeners are probably sitting here right now saying they've been out of the panhandle and they can't catch grouper, because when they drop a line in the water, they're catching these beautiful big red snapper. Those red snapper out there, for the most part now, are about 10 years old. A 25-year-old female red snapper will produce 250 eggs for every one that a 10-year-old fish produces. So the older these fish get, the more eggs they produce. So that's the part of the fishery we're missing. We need those 25-year-old fish out there that can create the abundance of eggs and restock the fishery back to the point that we're used to. One of the hopeful items in the future is we are working on a hatchery in Pensacola, which we are going to use to target red snapper. We've already had success with redfish. We can make redfish by the millions and release them. Have been very successful. The next effort, I think, is to be produce red snapper and hopefully get them back out into the Gulf and supplement that fishery so that there's a good fishery both for commercial and recreational take.
I'm talking with Kenneth Wright. He is the new chairman of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson. You can tell us what your interactions are with Florida wildlife online, Facebook and Twitter, or send an email over to intersection@WMFE.org. I know that Florida is looking at taking some funds from the BP oil spill to try to reestablish a network of fisheries in the panhandle and areas that were affected. Talk to me a little bit about that work and that effort.
There is a proposal to fund a hatchery in Pensacola. That process is currently underway in negotiations with BP and the trustees, if you will, of the various Gulf Coast states. Hopefully those negotiations will be resolved in the near term, but what's envisioned is to have a network of hatcheries from Florida all the way around to Texas, sharing the same infrastructure modeled after hatcheries that have been developed in Florida, from our experience. Each state having the same hatchery, sharing the science, so that we can, in hatcheries, create these highly sought-after commercial and recreational fish so that we can supplement the impact that we have had, not necessarily BP, but the impact that man has brought upon these fisheries by overfishing commercially or recreationally.
Talk to me about your own interests in outdoor activity. What do you like to do?
Well, I hunt and fish. Many years ago, I took my interests away from hunting because there's only so much time I have. But I'm a fisherman. I love to fly fish. I spend a lot of time in Mosquito Lagoon, and most recently down in the Keys in Biscayne Bay, I caught a 120-pound tarpon on a fly rod, which was pretty neat.
Sounds like quite a feat.
But I'm a fisherman, and I enjoy the outdoors. Have for many, many, many years.
Well, Kenneth Wright is the new chairman of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. It's been great speaking with you,
Mark. It's been great to speak with you, and I'll be glad to come back anytime. Thank you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.